From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The most important thing, whoever thinks about destabilizing Syria, he should know that he is going to destabilize the region. We are the safety valve in the region.
The safety valve?
Yeah, safety valve in the region.
In what way? How?
In a geopolitical way.
Today, a Democracy Now! U.S. broadcast exclusive, an interview with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He speaks with independent journalist Reese Ehrlich on the United States, the occupation of Iraq, human rights in Syria, and more. But first, Israel's bombardment of Lebanon enters its seventh day.
Israel now is a terrorist country that's committing every day a terrorist act.
We'll go to Beirut for a report from Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post, then a sampling of media from the Arab world with Link TV's Mosaic. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 215 people have now died during Israel's seven-day-old assault on Lebanon. All but 14 of the dead are civilians. The Israeli bombings have displaced more than 400,000 Lebanese residents from their homes. Tens of thousands of foreigners are trying to leave the country to escape the daily airstrikes. Early this morning, Israeli warplanes killed at least 11 people, including seven civilians from the same family in southern Lebanon. On Monday, Israeli attacks killed at least 42 people, making it one of the deadliest days of the week-old invasion. Among the dead were 12 civilians who were killed when an Israeli bomb hit their minivan just south of Beirut. Calls continue to mount for the international community to do something to stop the bloodshed, but there's been little progress on the diplomatic front. The cover of today's Guardian newspaper shows a photograph of a bombed-out section of Beirut under the headline, "Lebanon, the World Looks On." Israel's refusing to rule out a massive ground invasion of Lebanon. The Israeli military has been amassing troops, tanks, and artillery pieces along the border. The military has also called up thousands of reserve troops. On Monday, Israeli troops briefly crossed the Lebanese border, but then returned to Israel. The Washington Post has reported Israeli and U.S. officials are privately saying the Israeli bombing of Lebanon is expected to continue for several weeks. The paper also reports the U.S. is supporting Israel in its refusal to agree on a ceasefire. On Monday, President Bush was caught on tape privately telling British Prime Minister Tony Blair that he felt U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan's call for a ceasefire, quote, seems odd. Then Bush proceeded to curse as he blamed Syria for what was happening.
See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing it.
During a primetime televised address, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert vowed to continue the bombardment of Lebanon until Hezbollah is crippled. On Monday, Hezbollah fired 50 rockets at northern Israel. Several injuries were reported. Over the past week, Hezbollah rocket attacks have killed at least 24 Israelis, including 12 civilians. This is the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert.
Citizens of Israel, there are moments in the life of a nation in which it is committed to look straight into reality and say, that is enough. And I tell everybody, this is enough. Israel will not be taken hostage, not by terror gangs, not by a terror authority, and not by a sovereign country.
Israel says it will continue its assault until three conditions are met: the release of the two captured Israeli soldiers, the disarmament of Hezbollah, and for the Lebanese army to take control of southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, Lebanese Prime Minister Fuad Sinoura accused Israel of trying to turn Lebanon back 50 years.
Israel now is a terrorist country that's committing every day a terrorist act.
A new report by the Lebanese government shows that the Israeli airstrikes have devastated the country's infrastructure. Lebanon's airports and seaports have been destroyed. 38 roads have been cut off by bombs or shells, and 42 bridges have been destroyed. Power stations, water processing plants, grain silos, and gas stations have also been targeted, as well as communication and television antennas. The Daily Star newspaper in Beirut has accused Israel of violating the Geneva Conventions by attacking Lebanon's civilian infrastructure. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning of a looming humanitarian disaster. The World Health Organization expects the number of Lebanese residents displaced from their homes to reach 900,000 by the end of today. Over 100,000 people have already fled to Syria. Public parks in Beirut now resemble refugee camps filled with displaced residents. The UN peacekeeping force in South Lebanon has said it has been unable to deliver humanitarian aid to stranded civilians because Israel would not guarantee the safe passage of the aid workers. Last week, Israel's fire hit an ambulance run by the Lebanese Red Crescent. An organization report many injured people are also unable to reach hospitals because so many roads and bridges have been bombed. Food and medical supplies are also running out in areas. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of foreigners have begun fleeing the country in what has been described as one of the largest mass evacuations by sea in world history. Foreign embassies around the world have been sending in boats and helicopters to rescue citizens trying to escape the bombing. But the Bush administration is being accused of moving too slowly. 25,000 U.S. citizens are believed to be in Lebanon. According to the Detroit News, only 64 Americans had been evacuated as of Monday night. Lebanon's information minister, Ghazi Ridi, has accused Israel of using banned weapons in violation of international law. Reports in the Lebanese media have claimed Israel's used phosphorus incendiary bombs and vacuum bombs that suck up air and facilitate building collapses. The use of incendiary weapons against civilians has been banned since 1980. The U.S. military used similar phosphorus weapons during the siege of Fallujah in Iraq. Meanwhile, several legal experts in the United States have accused Israel of violating the U.S. Arms Export Control Act by using U.S.-made fighter planes and missiles to kill civilians and to destroy Lebanon's infrastructure. Defense experts say Israel has over 500 F-16 and F-15 fighter planes, all of them supplied by the United States. In Washington, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee is holding a peace rally outside the White House at 5 p.m. today to protest the Israeli military action in both Lebanon and Gaza. The group is the largest American Arab civil rights organization in the United States. Meanwhile, on Monday, thousands of supporters of Israel gathered in New York. Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton addressed the crowd, vowing support for Israel.
We will support her efforts to send a message to Hamas, Hezbollah, to the Syrians, to the Iranians, to all who seek death and domination instead of life and freedom, that we will not permit this to happen, and we will take whatever steps are necessary.
Prior to the rally, Fox News owner Rupert Murdoch threw a fundraising breakfast for Hillary Clinton in New York. In other news from around the world, a car bomb attack in the southern Iraqi city of Kufa has killed at least 53 people and injured 100 more. A crowd of laborers looking for work had been lured into gathering around a minibus, which then exploded. In Ouija, a roadside bomb near a bus station killed another 9 people, including 6 police officers. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports over 600 people died in Baghdad last week alone. The figure was provided by Iraq's Interior Ministry. In Indonesia, a tsunami hit the island of Java, killing at least 325 people. Another 140 are reported missing. An undersea earthquake triggered the tsunami, which produced a 6-foot wall of water. The tsunami has displaced over 50,000 people. More than 230,000 people were killed in a massive tsunami that hit the region in December of 2004. In Britain, officials have decided not to press to prosecute any of the police officers involved in the shooting death of Jean-Charles de Meneses. He was the innocent Brazilian man shot in the London subway last year after police mistook him to be a possible terrorist. In Chile, the country's Supreme Court has ruled a major human rights lawsuit against former dictator Augusto Pinochet can proceed. 4 years ago, the same court ruled Pinochet was unfit to stand trial because of dementia. But on Monday, the court reversed itself. Monday's high court ruling will allow Pinochet to be tried for the so-called Caravan of Death case dating back to 1973. After Pinochet seized power in the 73 coup, he oversaw the systematic execution of political opponents. By the time of his 17-year dictatorship's end, more than 3,000 people had died in political killings, and tens of thousands more had been arrested and tortured. On Capitol Hill, the Senate's expected to vote today to approve expanding embryonic stem cell research. But President Bush is threatening to issue the first veto of his presidency in order to block the legislation. A debate over stem cell research has split the Republican Party. Several prominent party members, including former First Lady Nancy Reagan and Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist, back the research. But many religious leaders who oppose abortion claim that conducting medical experiments on fertilized human eggs amounts to ending human lives. And former South African President Nelson Mandela turns 88 years old today. On Monday, he held a private party with the staff of his foundation. Mandela spent 27 years in jail under the apartheid regime. He said he never expected to live to be 88.
Well, thank you very much. This is a wonderful occasion, and I thank you.
Thank you.
And to be loved by people with whom you work is something very important.
Former South African President Nelson Mandela. He's 88 years old. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel continues to target Lebanon's infrastructure and bomb civilian neighborhoods. United Nations is warning of a looming humanitarian disaster. The World Health Organization expects the number of Lebanese residents displaced to reach 900,000 people by the end of today. Just before the program went to air, we reached Anthony Shadid in Beirut. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke about the mounting crisis in Lebanon.
Over Beirut last night, although today seems to be a little bit quieter, at least in the capital. A lot of the fighting has been going on in southern Lebanon, which has become increasingly difficult for journalists to get down to because of roads being cut and generally pretty hazardous situation down there. You're starting to see some hints of diplomacy, although there's a certain pessimism that they'll be breaking through soon. Lebanese officials said last night that some ideas have imploded out there, but the exact framework of those ideas or how some kind of negotiations might take place is still pretty unclear. What you're seeing in Beirut and parts of the mountain hinterland that overlook the capital is very significant flows of refugees. Lebanese officials say more than 60,000 people have been displaced from their homes in the southern suburbs of Beirut. They're becoming Shiite Muslim and also a source of support for Hezbollah. As well as southern Lebanon, people arriving by cars, vans, taxis, and usually picking up residence in schools. A lot of the schools you see in Beirut are overwhelmed by refugees at this point. In one school we visited yesterday, more than 1,000, sometimes four, sometimes five families in a classroom. Local parties, sometimes activists, have been trying to supply them with food, water, blankets, this type of thing. But they themselves admit that it can go on for a few more days before a more substantive campaign, a more organized campaign gets into what to take care of them. You're also seeing in a rare moment of unity among some of the Lebanese factions who are usually fiercely at odds, have come together to try to help some of these refugees, in particular Michelle Aoun's group, who's a Christian leader, very popular among Christians here. His group is no one active in helping refugees, but you've also seen other groups, a Sunni Muslim group, the Philippines, Saad Hariri, the son of the slain prime minister, as well as the Druze faction that belongs to Walid Jumblatt. Opening schools, trying to supply aid and trying to supply food and water. That's been going on. The pace of it has picked up in the last 48 hours.
Washington Post reporter Anthony Shadid reporting from Lebanon. Israel's bombardment of Lebanon has entered its seventh day. The death toll continues to rise. More than 215 people have been killed, all but 14 of them civilian. The country's infrastructure has been devastated. More than 400,000 people have been displaced. Hezbollah continues to fire rockets into Israel. At least 24 Israelis, including 12 civilians, have been killed. Meanwhile, the international community has no plan to stop the bloodshed, and there's been little progress on the diplomatic front. News networks across the United States have been closely following the story over the past week. But how is the news delivered in the Middle East? In the U.S., there's one place to find out, Mosaic, a daily show on our partner network, Link TV, that compiles television news reports from more than 30 TV outlets throughout the Middle East. Last year, Mosaic won one of journalism's highest honors, the Peabody Award. This is an edited excerpt of last night's newscast from across the Middle East.
Almost all Lebanese television networks provided wall-to-wall coverage of the war. Future TV gave a summary of the sixth day of the intense bombing of Lebanon.
The Israeli aggression targeted various Lebanese areas, from the bombing of the airport at night to bombing Beirut, where two people were martyred and many others were killed. Like other days, the bombing did not spare the southern suburb of Beirut. Beirut has been targeted with a number of missiles in separate attacks. The attacks reached Shouf, where five citizens were martyred and 23 others were wounded in an attack on one of the bridges. The bombing in the north included the Abdi port in a car, according to civilian and Lebanese army witnesses. The Tripoli International port was also bombed. The Israeli military campaign also targeted Belbak, where three civilians were martyred and six others were injured. Israeli warplanes also raided the Jalala village in central Bekaa, where two civilians were martyred and 22 others were wounded. Israeli warplanes carried out 60 raids on Sunday night, according to a survey by the Israeli army. Initial surveys indicate that at least 20 people were martyred and 40 others were injured.
Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, appeared on all Lebanese television stations, including LBC, a Christian-run network.
As long as the enemy aggression has no limits and red lines, our defiance will also have no limits and red lines. The arsenal that you are very concerned about is still available. What was launched so far is only a very small part of this arsenal. We still have the ability to launch more missiles. Today, the Zionists are making all their calculations on the premise that Hezbollah's missiles will only reach Haifa, Acre, and Tigris. We could launch tens of missiles to distance further from Haifa. If you want to fight your battle on the basis of this assumption, then I want to let you know that you will be defeated, God willing.
Another Lebanese network, NBN, showed hours of raw footage of the carnage of the war. This report, titled The Massacre of Mirwahin, was shown several times, accompanied only by solemn music. IBA, the Israeli official state television, focused on the damage caused by a barrage of Hezbollah rockets which hit Haifa.
After a quiet night, Haifa turned into a war zone this afternoon as Hezbollah missile attacks caused a three-story building to collapse, injuring dozens. Joining us now live from Haifa is IBA's Leah Zinder. Leah?
Yes, Laura, I join you now from a site of devastation where a three-story house collapsed here in a suburb of Haifa. The day began very quietly. A night and a morning of complete quiet were shattered at 1:45 this afternoon when the sirens started going off, followed by an onslaught of rockets. No fewer than 50 rockets landed here in Haifa and in the north of the country. Fortunately, in most of those attacks, there were no injuries. But as you see right behind me, I believe you're looking at it now, this three-story building collapsed. Now, one person was seriously injured in that incident, three others moderately injured. Miraculously, nobody was killed.
Meanwhile, Nile TV out of Egypt, aside from the coverage of the conflict, focused on the Egyptian public opinion.
This is a natural response because violence gives birth to violence. Hezbollah's latest operation was a natural response to this Israeli arrogance. Hezbollah now feels that it has a presence and the ability to respond.
Should the Israeli soldier who was captured by the Palestinians be treated in a respectful and honorable way, while the Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners of war that are in Israel prisons are not? Aren't they humans? Do they not have legal rights and dignity?
News reports from around the Middle East, an excerpt of Mosaic World News from the Middle East. We're joined now by Jamal Dajani, the director of Middle Eastern programming at Link TV that produces Mosaic. Welcome to Democracy Now! Now, Jamal.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this coverage?
Well, you know, there is a unique coverage that's going on now because there is a split in the perspectives even within the Arab world and the Lebanese television stations. Since the beginning of the war, with the statements issued by Saudi Arabia condemning Hezbollah, in essence, or pointing the finger at Hezbollah, it created a split debate, an opinion, going on between different broadcasters. For example, you know, some of the Lebanese networks, we have been showing footage from four different Lebanese networks, and some has been critical of Hezbollah. And that has created a lot of debate on the air. So that's a very unique situation here. Also, we have a situation where you have another ongoing war now in Iraq. As your news report mentioned, you know, in Kufa, 39 people died today. This hardly made any news in the Arab world, which is really unusual, where you have wall-to-wall coverage on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and other broadcasters about what's going on in Lebanon. And you don't have, or you have very little about Iraq. Meanwhile, some of the Arab networks that are aligned with that position, the Saudi position in the Gulf, they have been having business as usual. I mean, they have not been covering the war in the same manner that what happened during the Iraqi war, when all the networks were coming with quick updates and showing you immediate reports about the attacks. I mean, we have an ongoing war. This is not just an incursion. And you have probably 60% of the Arab networks showing soap operas, showing game shows, music, songs. And while only the Lebanese are left alone, only the Lebanese are offering you wall-to-wall coverage, plus Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and the rest are, this is unprecedented. Also, you know, just to, you know, one of the reports that we showed you was from Nile TV, and it was talking about, I mean, showing you the perspective of the people on the street in Egypt. And this is in contrast of the Egyptian position, of the position of Hosni Mubarak, coming, you know, in critical about Hezbollah, but we have been seeing the Arab masses speaking against the Israeli incursion there, speaking against their own governments. They had yesterday marches in the streets in Kuwait. So a lot of things are going on. Also, it's a unique coverage also from different angles. The Western media is now is also present in Beirut. This is a difference that when we had war on Iraq, where the Western media did not come to into Baghdad till the American soldiers were there. The Israeli media has been recently censored. The past 24 hours, Israel authority has been censoring coverage on the attacks on the, in the north, and more specifically on Al Jazeera. They have prevented Al Jazeera from covering the sites where Hezbollah has been hitting and attacking in Haifa and other areas.
Jamal Dajani, I wanted to ask you about this issue of censorship. On CNN yesterday, host Kira Phillips was interviewing Steve Hartov, a former soldier in the Israeli army who's now a military analyst. I wanted to play an excerpt of that interview and then ask for your comment. This is CNN's anchor, Kira Phillips.
I want to ask you about the Israeli Defense Force stepping in and asking the media to stop showing certain images in the area. We have struck a deal that it's a war-sensitive time. There have to be certain censorship issues. Tell me why the IDF is asking us to back off on certain specific pictures.
Well, Kira, it's difficult for Western viewers sometimes to understand the aspects of what we might call here censorship. But in fact, if you've got a camera, for instance, in Haifa, and you report that a rocket has fallen in a particular neighborhood, you become a forward observer for the enemy.
Jamal Dajani of Mosaic, your response.
Well, I mean, you know, Hezbollah has been hitting Haifa. You have an entire coverage, a one-sided coverage of the war. You have cameras all over Lebanon, all over Beirut. You know, we're getting information there uninterrupted, uncensored. And then after, you know, they started in the initial phase when the Israelis were surprised themselves with the capabilities of Hezbollah, that Hezbollah was able to strike into Haifa, they started censoring first Al Jazeera. I know the other networks like Israeli Broadcast Authority and Western media were allowed to film those areas. We were allowed to interview the people. And then all of a sudden, this happened just within the past 24 hours. They decided, and I think, you know, they decided after they heard Nasrallah talking about that everything now is game, you know, for the attack. But I think, you know, if Hezbollah was prepared to attack Haifa, they already know where are the chemical plants. And they already know, they have probably operatives on the ground. I mean, it's a whole, you know, I mean, these days, you know almost everything from Google video. So I think the Israelis are more concerned about the public opinion showing the amount of damage that is going on, because I think the Israelis are not prepared for a long-term war of attrition like the Lebanese. I mean, if you saw what you saw in the footage we showed you, the Lebanese have been now subjected, and they've been seeing the horrifying images of the war, and I think a lot of the Israelis are not aware of what's going on in their own country.
How much is the media in different Arab countries like Saudi Arabia watched, as opposed to satellite television, the networks like Al Jazeera?
Well, I mean, throughout the Arab world, I mean, you have access to more than 200 different satellite networks. So although the Saudis are also practicing censorship, because the Saudis, you know, they have their own take on the war, and they have not been showing the devastation that has been shown on Al Jazeera, on Al Arabiya, on LBC, on NBN. But I think the average Saudi citizen can access all these networks. I don't think the people in the area are shielded from the horrifying images of the war. But I think from the Israeli side, there is a definite censorship in showing the extent of the damage, or what cities have been hit, or the injured people.
Jamal Dajani, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Director of Middle East Programming at Link TV and producer of Mosaic World News from the Middle East. Link TV is on both TV satellite networks in this country, on Dish Network Channel 9410 and on DirecTV Channel 375, where Democracy Now! Broadcasts as well. Thanks so much for joining us from San Francisco. When we come back from our break, our U.S. broadcast exclusive interview with the president of Syria. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. As the bombardment of Lebanon continues, the United States and Israel have been calling on Syria to pressure Hezbollah to back down, to release the two captured Israeli soldiers. On Monday, President Bush was caught on tape at the G8 summit, speaking privately to the British Prime Minister Tony Blair. On the tape, he curses and blames Syria for the current crisis.
See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing shit, and it's over.
Meanwhile, former CIA Director James Woolsey appeared on Fox yesterday to call for U.S. airstrikes against Syria. Damascus has warned that it'll respond in a, quote, unlimited manner to any Israeli attacks on the country. Meanwhile, a massive pro-Hezbollah rally was held in Damascus yesterday. Today, we bring you a Democracy Now! U.S. broadcast exclusive, an interview with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Last month, he gave a wide-ranging interview to independent journalist Reese Erlich in Damascus. Erlich's a freelance foreign correspondent, reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, National Public Radio. Reese Erlich is also co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And he now joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reese.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Can you talk about this interview that we're about to play? What were the circumstances of it? Where did you interview the president of Syria?
I interviewed him at the presidential palace up on a hill above Damascus where he has his formal meetings. It's a very impressive place. You go in and you have about 8 miles of red carpet and huge doors, and it's quite an impressive entrance. And then out of a little room comes the president of Syria and welcomes you in and shakes your hand. He's a very friendly guy. I've had an opportunity to interview presidents from a number of different countries, and most of them are rather stiff and formal. He was very informal, easy to talk to, was forthcoming in the interview, and we talked about a whole range of issues from Iran and Syria and U.S. relations and terrorism down to issues of democratic rights inside Syria.
I want to turn to the first part of that interview right now, where, Reese Erlich, you started by asking President Bashar al-Assad if he was concerned the United States might also be considering Syria as a target for military action. Mind you, this is before the current conflict. You asked him if the U.S. might also consider Syria as a target. This is the president of Syria answering.
Actually, Syria is a history of 5,000 years, and it made its history, it made its presence, and it will make its future. The people in Syria will decide who's going to be in charge, who's going on the helm, and who's not. But the most important thing, whoever thinks about destabilizing Syria, he should know that he is going to destabilize the region. We are the safety valve in the region.
The safety valve?
Yeah, safety valve in the region.
In what way?
How? In a geopolitical way, mm-hmm. The history of Syria, the role of the Syria and the region, the link between the Syria and our neighbors, social links, ideological links, and the interest links with the region. So the whole region is connected with each other.
You mentioned that in the past Syria has helped provide intelligence about terrorist groups, al-Qaeda and so on. Explain that, and when did that cooperation end?
Actually, we started cooperating with the United States. We took the initiative to cooperate with the United States intelligence after 11th of September. And we succeeded in preventing more than seven plots made by al-Qaeda against the United States. The cooperation stopped last March in 2005. Because of mistakes were made by the United States first, second, because of their political position or stand against Syria.
What were the mistakes made by the United States?
Technical mistakes that led to losing many opportunities to go forward in fighting terrorism in the region.
That was also around the time in which the U.S. was pressuring Lebanon to demand the return of Syrian troops and the charges about Hariri and so on and so forth. So did that, in general, that sour the political atmosphere?
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you think the Bush administration will militarily attack Iran, using the issue of nuclear weapons development, supposedly, that Iran is involved in? Do you think that's likely?
Anyway, it's a hypothetical question, but if we want to talk about logic and the interest of the region and of the United States and the rest of the world, is not to do such a thing, because the whole world will pay very expensive price.
What would be the consequences if the U.S. did either try to impose sanctions or even a military strike on Iran?
Sanctions won't do anything. From the experience in Iraq and many different countries, sanctions won't do anything. But the consequences of destabilizing the region by sanctions, by military actions, by any kind of means will lead to destabilizing the whole Middle East.
Iran has a number of options should something like that happen. For example, it can work with its supporters in Iraq to attack U.S. forces when they're not doing that now. It has influence with Hezbollah, and that it could inflame the situation there. Do you think those would be some of the examples of the destabilization?
I think the question should be asked to the Iranian. I mean, what they're going to do. But for me, the consequences are much deeper. If you look at Iraq as an example, you cannot talk about factions or parties or groups. It's much more deeper than this. It's chaos. It's going to be a total chaos. Yeah.
Reese Erlich interviewing the president of Syria. We're going to go back to that interview, joined by Reese Erlich in studio in San Francisco and Patrick Seal, British journalist who's covered the Middle East for over 30 years, who wrote the biography of Assad called Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. Patrick Seal, I wanted to go to you in France right now to give us a little background on Assad, on the president of Syria, and to also your response to this first part of the interview.
Well, as you know, he's been in power for about 6 years now. He took over from his father when his father died in June 2000. He is an eye doctor. He's trained as an eye doctor in Britain and in Syria. He wasn't really prepared for power, so he's had a rather hard innings, particularly, of course, since the attack on Iraq by the United States, which has probably go down in history as a monumental blunder. Nevertheless, he has proved a very tough defender of Syrian interests, and it's striking that he should make this claim that that to destabilize Syria is to destabilize the whole region. I think that's really, in a way, one of his key remarks. It points to his concern and his attempt to persuade the world that Syria has an important regional role and continues to have that role.
Can you give us more on the background, Patrick Seal, of how Bashar al-Assad rose to power? And then also, if you could talk about the reference to Rafiq Hariri, the Lebanese leader who was assassinated last year.
Well, he rose to power in a way. It was a sort of joint decision of the political elite in Damascus after his father died. He seemed the natural candidate. And in fact, his father had, I think, to some extent prepared him for this task in the 6 years since his elder brother, Basil, died in a car crash. His elder brother, Basil, was the acknowledged heir. When he died, then they recalled Dr. Bashar from London, where he was studying ophthalmology, and he was then trained to succeed his father. But as I said, it's not been an easy problem. Now, the Lebanon is vitally important for Syria's security. Syria cannot tolerate a hostile power in the Lebanon. And this, I think, lies at the root of much of Syria's policy. If you may recall that in 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon, killing about 17,000 Lebanese and Palestinians, and attempting to bring Lebanon into its orbit with the help of the United States. George Shultz at the time, the American Secretary of State, tried to broker a separate peace between Israel and Lebanon, which would have put Lebanon in Israel's sphere of influence. And the Israelis were anxious to install a puppet government in Beirut, which would do their bidding. Now, the Syrians managed to overturn that accord, and bring Syria, bring Lebanon back into their sphere of influence, which, as I said, is necessary for their security, but is also a reflection of the numerous ties between the two countries. They are tied, intimately tied, by family ties, trade ties, financial ties, and, of course, historical ties. So for all these reasons, Syria has a very strong interest in the Lebanon. Now, we don't know whether or not Syria killed the former Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafik Hariri. The investigation into that murder is still continuing, and indeed into the murders which followed. Many people have pointed the finger at Syria and have argued that Rafik Hariri wanted to change the relationship between the two countries. But as I say, it remains unproven to this day.
I want to talk to you about the cooperation between Syria and the United States. But first, we're going to go back to the interview. Again, this is an interview done before the current conflict. Independent reporter Reese Erlich in this Democracy Now! U.S. broadcast exclusive, speaking to the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad.
Does Syria plan to demarcate its borders with Lebanon? And then a second related question, or open embassies between the two?
The first part about the borders, we had a formal letter from the Lebanese Prime Minister, and we sent him a formal reply, that we are ready to demarcate the borders. We don't have any problem, because we have such problem with Jordan a few years ago, and we solved it. About the embassies, as a concept, we cannot say you don't want to have embassy in another country, as concept. But that needs normal relation. Now we don't have this normal relation with the Lebanese. So it needs better relation to discuss this issue.
What kinds of issues would have to be resolved in order to have normal relation?
First of all, not to have a government that works against your country. This first of all. And second of all, you need the Syrians to feel that they have real neighbors, not a cradle or not a hub for terrorists to come and do such terrorist acts in Syria.
One last question. What would it take to improve relations between the United States and Syria now? Are there any steps that could be taken that would improve?
Definitely by the United States, not by Syria, because we did a lot and we couldn't get any result because they don't have the will. So first of all, they should know and they should understand the situation in the region. They should appreciate the role of Syria in the region. They should know that we have common interest that they don't see. And I think they should be neutral in dealing with our causes. That's how we can get back our relation to normal.
So do you want to be any more specific about your causes and that they should change?
Yeah, definitely. The most important thing, our occupied land, Golan Heights, the United States should take into consideration that we see everything in Syria through our occupied land. Without talking about peace process, in order to get this land back, what the benefit of this relation? Mm-hmm. So that's how.
Okay. Mm. Anything else you would like to add in a message to the American people?
I think after the 11th of September, which was very tough lesson, not to the United States people, to everybody in this world, first of all, you should learn more about what's going on behind the ocean all over the world. You should send more people, more delegations to meet with other cultures, to discuss with them, to know the facts. Not to be isolated away from the rest of the world.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, when we come back from break, he will talk about the war in Iraq, and we'll continue with our conversation with Patrick Seale, who wrote the biography of Assad, called Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. And we'll also speak with Reese Erlich, who did the interview with the Syrian president in Damascus. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll continue our interview that we're bringing you in this U.S. broadcast exclusive. Independent journalist Reese Ehrlich was in Damascus last month and interviewed the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. We're also joined on the telephone by Patrick Seal from France, who wrote the biography of Assad's father. It's called Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. Patrick Seal, as you listen to this interview and hear Bashar al-Assad talk about the United States, can you comment on the relationship that Assad has had with the United States as well as Lebanon?
Well, Syria, there's terrible noise on this line. Can you hear it?
We can hear the sound, but we can also hear the, we can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Well, it's incredible noise. 1 second, please. Can you?
We can hear you if you can try to ignore the sound.
Me, can you?
We can hear you fine.
Well, Syria has always sought better relations with the United States. Now, it's suffered very much from what it considers America's alignment on Israel. Indeed, it's striking that President Bashar should urge the United States to be more even-handed, more neutral in its approach to the Middle East, and not only, of course, on the Palestinian question, but also on the subject very dear to Syrian hearts, the occupied Golan. Now, as you know, Israel occupied the Golan in 1967, and the United States, in spite of Security Council resolutions 242, 338, has allowed that occupation to stand, as it has allowed the occupation of Palestinian territories to stand for the last 39 years. The United States allowed Israel to occupy Lebanon, southern Lebanon, for 22 years and occupy the Palestinian territories for 39 years. Now, these are the reasons why many, many Arabs are very disgruntled, very hostile to the United States. Now, the United States believes that that Israel can use force to keep to protect its own supremacy in the region, but this is increasingly contested. And so in terms of President Bashar al-Assad, he made very clear that Syria cannot tolerate the use of Lebanon to mount hostile operations against Syria. That's when he was answering the question about why not restore, have an exchange of embassies, have diplomatic relations with Lebanon. He said, well, we could do that once we have normal relations and once we have a Lebanese government in Beirut which doesn't work against Syria or cooperate with its enemies. So he was very clear on all those issues, and his appeal to the United States was to understand the region better, understand that there are other countries in the region apart from Israel with whom the United States has common interests and should recognize those interests.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh detailed several years ago how the Bush administration destroyed U.S.-Syrian relations by attacking a convoy of cars inside Syria in an attempt to assassinate Saddam Hussein. It turned out the convoy was made up of cars that were smuggling goods out of Iraq, and Syria has since stopped cooperating with the United States.
Well, that's true. It wasn't just that. I mean, the Syria, like many other countries in the world, like France, like Germany, was very much opposed to the attack on Iraq. I mean, the Syrians had no love for Saddam Hussein, but the idea that the United States should attack, an unprovoked attack against a major Arab country and smash it and kill tens of thousands of people and then accuse Syria of all countries of interfering or Iran of interfering when the United States, which previously had a policy of over the horizon, of keeping away from the heartland of the Middle East, suddenly makes this qualitative leap of attacking a major Arab state. This has caused consternation in the region, and of course the Syrians feel threatened. They feel that they may be next. At least they felt that in the early stages of the attack. Now I think they feel a bit more confident because of the quagmire in which the United States finds itself. I mean, it looks very much as if the neocons, the pro-Israeli neocons in influential positions in the U.S. administration, took the United States for a ride. involved it in this attack on Iraq, no doubt believing this would improve Israel's strategic environment. But this has proved a catastrophe for the United States, extremely costly in men and treasure.
Patrick Seale, we're going to go back to the interview that independent journalist Reese Erlich did with the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, last month, again, before the current conflict.
President Bush made a surprise visit to Baghdad today, yesterday and today. Zarqawi was killed. Do you think that the Bush administration is trying to say that they're making progress now in Iraq? Well, first of all, do you think that's accurate? Or do you think the U.S. in some ways has actually already lost the war?
Lost the war and making progress are linked together. So we have to ask what the goal first. So if the goal democracy, the answer is very clear. The situation is much worse than before, even during Saddam, that we don't defend in Syria. If they talk about better living standards, the situation much, much worse than before. If they are talking about development, about infrastructure, about anything, so everything is worse. So that depends on what the goal of the war. You cannot talk about occupation. I mean, occupation is not the goal of the war. This is the mean occupation. But but if we talk about the military side of the war, killing Americans every day in Iraq, and of course killing Iraqis, tens of Iraqis every week. Is that the goal of the war from the military point of view? I don't think so. The answer is very clear for us.
But even in a military sense, the U.S. no longer controls certain areas of Iraq. It's very unstable even in the south, in the Basra area. It would seem that even from a strictly military standpoint, the situation has gotten worse from the U.S. Do you think that's true?
It's self-evident. No power, no military power in the world, even the United States, can control a small country militarily. You can only control a country if the people want you to control it. When the people are against you, and this is very normal, to have the people against the occupation in Iraq and in any other country, you're going to have resistance, and you will not control anything. This is normal.
What do you think the outcome is going to be if you said a few years from now? What do you think the situation will look like in Iraq?
That depends on the constitution, first of all. You need consensus. If you want to talk about the future of Iraq, we should talk about a consensus about something. And normally the future of Iraq is going to be inside the constitution. So far, and according to what we hear from many Iraqis factions, some factions think they are oppressed. So this needs to be reevaluated. I think this is the core of the future. If there's no consensus about the constitution, you will have conflict or maybe a civil war. This is the core event. Not having a new government or having some election. This is good. We support in Syria, we support the political process, but this is not enough. This is for the short term, it's okay. For the long term, no, it's not enough.
Sources have told me that you've been involved in promoting some negotiations between the Sunni resistance and the government. Is that accurate?
Actually, what we try to promote is the unified Iraq. This is only the only thing. We try to see what's in common between the whole Iraqis, and we try to make some negotiations, some marketing, some ideas that the Iraqi would think it helps unifying Iraq or keep it unified so far. And this is how we put our role as in general.
But specifically, have you helped facilitate some talks between the resistance, the people opposed, fighting the United States and the Iraqi government?
Actually, the delegation that comes to Syria, we don't know if they are resistance or not. They are Iraqis. And they don't know. Nobody knows who are the resistance unless the Iraqis. So don't believe if anyone tells you that he knows who the resistance. So, but definitely, most of them, most of the Iraqis that we meet, they are supporting the resistance, at least politically.
And are you trying to facilitate those the political supporters to hold negotiations with the government?
Yeah, we always say that we are ready to help in any way, but definitely Syria is open for this, and we tried to. Yeah, we did some effort.
There's been recent deaths on the beach in Gaza. Hamas has ended its ceasefire with Israel. It seems like a very great struggle is reemerging now in Palestine. What is your prediction for the next short-term period in Palestine?
You mean the Iraqi, the Palestinian-Palestinian relation, or
Palestinian-Israeli relations? Yeah.
Of course, when you have conflict between the Palestinians, you won't have peace talk in the near future. So I'm talking from the West point of view now, not from our point. From our point of view, it's something between the Palestinians, something humanitarian. We consider them as brothers. But I think the Palestinians are paying the price of Oslo Treaty in 1993. And they pay the price of the paralyzed peace process, especially after the 2000 negotiation Camp David and the deadlock that they reached between the Palestinian and the Israeli, and the negligence of the American administration of the peace process in general.
The president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, speaking with independent journalist Reese Ehrlich, we're going to go to in a minute, but I wanted to ask Patrick Seale quickly in France about how much control you think Syria has over Hezbollah in Lebanon now.
Well, Hezbollah is, of course, its ally, as it is the ally of Iran. This doesn't mean that it has full control over Hezbollah. Hezbollah has become an autonomous player, particularly ever since it managed to expel the Israelis from Lebanon, for most of Lebanon, in the year 2000. Of course, Israel continues to occupy a small area known as the Shabar Farms on the pretext that they actually belong to Syria rather than Lebanon. Syria says, no, these are Lebanese. But nevertheless, the Israelis maintain their occupation there and, of course, are holding a lot of prisoners. Now, both the Hamas attack, which captured an Israeli soldier, and Hezbollah's attack, which captured two Israeli soldiers, these were intended to act to serve as bargaining counters to force Israel to release some of the many, many prisoners it holds. It holds about 10,000.
Patrick Seale, we're going to leave it there for today. We're going to play more of the interview tomorrow. Reese Ehrlich, we have 30 seconds. Your final comment today on this part of the interview you did with the Syrian president.
Well, I think it's clear that he has accurately portrayed the difficulties the U.S. faces in Iraq. It's an unwinnable war. Hundreds of thousands of refugees are fleeing Iraq to live in Syria, including 18,000 Christian Iraqis who have fled as a result of their churches being attacked and their communities being attacked, something that even Saddam Hussein never dared to do.
Reese Ehrlich, I want to thank you for sharing this interview. We'll play more of it tomorrow. Reese Ehrlich, independent journalist recently back from Syria, and Patrick Seale, author of Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. Tomorrow again, part two of the interview. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hubert Okaduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.